Eileen Hirsch of the State Public Defender's Office. Ms. Hirsch.
Thank you and good morning. As the Chief Justice said, I am Eileen Hirsch. I represent David Dearborn. He was stopped by a state conservation warden for driving after revocation of his license. And when he was stopped, he got out of his truck, locked the truck, met the warden at the back of his truck. When the warden double-checked his information and told him he was under arrest, the warden reached for his wrist, Mr. Dearborn pulled back, and they got involved in a physical scuffle. State trooper was called, Mr. Dearborn was subdued, arrested, handcuffed, and secured in the back of the trooper's car. At that point, the warden unlocked Mr. Dearborn's truck and searched it incident to arrest. Mr. Dearborn has raised two issues on appeal. One is the constitutionality of the search. The other is the constitutionality of the jury instruction. The state has conceded that under the decision in Arizona versus Gant, the search did not meet the requirements of the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution and presumably Article 1, Section 11 of the Wisconsin Constitution. What I'd like to focus on in oral argument today is the other issue the state raised, which is whether the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule should be applied to this case. I'd like to begin, as I think we all must begin, with the retroactivity rule. What the retroactivity rule says is when the U.S. Supreme Court announces a new rule or what a newly announced interpretation of the Constitution, that decision applies to cases that are currently on appeal, non-final cases. Now, back before 1965, it also applied to cases on collateral review, but there was a change and some turmoil in that rule. But since 1987, the retroactivity rule is that it applies to cases that are currently non-final, currently on review.
Well, that means if the case was, verdict wasn't in yet in the circuit court, but there was no suppression, it means if it was before the Court of Appeals,
right,
and there was a decision, but no review had been filed here. Anything that's not finally decided by this court, but could be.
Correct.
But could be, right.
And also any case that would be on a writ of cert to the U.S. Supreme Court would also be covered mm-hmm. by that.
Okay. So what's the timing on this case?
This case was on, let me think about this. The case was decided by the Court of Appeals. We actually argued in this case that the search was not constitutional, relying a great deal on the decision and the concurrence in the Thornton case, the concurrence by Justice Scalia, and the decision by the Arizona Supreme Court in State versus Gant. While the petition for review was pending, the cert was waiting on the U.S. Supreme Court in Arizona versus Gant, this court stayed its decision on the petition for review. Arizona versus Gant was decided.
Couldn't remember if we did that here or in Little John or both.
Both cases. They came together. What's interesting to me about the state's analysis, and it takes this analysis from the Tenth Circuit decision in McCain, is that it misinterprets, I think clearly misinterprets, the retroactivity rule. What the footnote that's referred to in McCain says, in effect, we are aware of the retroactivity rule, but that only says that Arizona versus Gant applies. It doesn't deal with whether the evidence should be excluded or not. And I think on that point, the McCain court and the state in this case are absolutely wrong. And we recently sent over to the court the decision in Danforth versus Minnesota, in which the court discussed the retroactivity rule, a 2008 case. And in that case, the court
said... And that to the clerk's office, counsel?
We did. We filed it with the clerk's office last week.
And the date?
On Thursday last week, whatever date that
okay,
is.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
I think the same date the state filed some new authority as well. But it was already cited in the brief. In the brief, I cited the case of DeSist versus United States and also Linkletter versus United States. Cases from the 60s and perhaps early 70s. in which, in desist, the court was talking about the exclusion of electronic eavesdropping evidence as required by CAS. And it said that retroactivity, applying the retroactivity rule in that case, would result in exclusion of electronic eavesdropping evidence seized. Linkletter made the same comments about applying the Mapp versus Ohio decision, that there would be cases coming back for exclusion of the evidence. And in Danforth versus Minnesota, which is a 2008 decision, the court specifically addressed this issue, and it said that the retroactivity rule is one of remedy and relief. And in fact, it said in a footnote that it would be, make more sense of to speak of it as redressability. And so the rule of retroactivity, first and most important, is a rule that says when a case is decided, that decision and its remedy are applicable to non-final cases. And the defendants in those non-final cases are entitled to the relief sought. So I think that's the first important point and the first important flaw in the state's argument. It has major connotations for the rest of the arguments made here today, because as you know, there's been argument in both the briefs about whether the good faith exclusion should apply given the policies behind the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, and what the implications of that would be, and also whether the police were reasonably relied on the decisions in Belton and Frye.
Under that argument, then, counsel, conceivably, people in the pipeline would be entitled to the same relief as in Gant, which is affirming the Arizona Supreme Court, which had suppressed
correct
the evidence, but not necessarily would that relief attend to cases that were not in the pipeline. Not necessarily.
Final cases, certainly. Cases on collateral review. In cases on collateral review, they go back to the rules of 1965 to 1987, which is a case-by-case determination of whether the new decision would affect the final cases.
Mm-hmm.
Correct. But where I was going with that is to just understand that I'm really focusing on the retroactivity issue, because if you agree with me on that, then it doesn't matter whether they reasonably relied on State versus Frye, and it doesn't matter about the policy reasons of the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. It is our belief today that the retroactivity rule governs, and that that's the end of the discussion. Now, I want to raise one other point that was raised in McCain from the footnote.
Before you do that, Let's assume for a minute that we don't totally accept your argument on retroactivity, and that we see some tension between retroactivity on one side and the good faith exception on the other side. How do you see us resolving that? I know what you'd like us to say is retroactivity wins, but is there a balancing that you think would take place if we recognize that tension?
Actually, it leads me to my next point. I thank you for the question, because
it's the ESP.
I'm sure we're on the same page here. What the court said in McCain is that in Leon, I'm quoting from their footnote 5, not exactly quoting, but paraphrasing from their footnote 5, that in Leon, the Supreme Court considered the tension between the retroactive application of the Fourth Amendment decisions and the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, stating that retroactivity in this context had been assessed largely in terms of the contribution that retroactivity may make to deterrence. However, if you go to that part of Leon, as I did, I'm looking at Leon footnote 9, and it makes that statement, and then it says, the last sentence of that footnote says, contrary to respondents' assertions, nothing in Johnson precludes adoption of a good faith exception tailored to situations in which the police have reasonably relied on a warrant issued by a detached and neutral magistrate, but later found to be defective. And so I just want to talk very briefly about the good faith exclusion and come back to whether those two doctrines, retroactivity and good faith, can meet. And The Leon good faith exception relied very, very heavily on the fact that this was a warrant situation. It begins by reminding us that the Fourth Amendment prefers a warrant. They prefer the judgment of a neutral and detached magistrate, and searches that are based on warrants under the Fourth Amendment are presumptively reasonable. In this case, and actually that has been applied in almost every U.S. Supreme Court and Wisconsin State Supreme Court case on the good faith exception, everyone that I know of, except Illinois versus Crow, is a warrant situation, including State versus Ward, State versus Eason, State versus Loringer. Those are all warrant situations, as are the Supreme Court decisions, including the most recent decision quoted heavily by the state, Herring. They all begin with the presumption of reasonableness. This is a search that begins with the presumption of unreasonableness. And so the first point in Leon is that Leon specifically distinguishes the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule from the retroactivity rule based on the fact that this is a warrant. It's a presumed reasonable search. So that's the first point about these two doctrines. The second point is actually a little more complicated and requires a very brief, I'll try to make a very brief history analysis. Until 1965, the common law rule was that the retroactivity rule made all decisions applicable to both final and non-final cases. In Desist versus United States, the court said, that's not really a constitutional rule, it's not required. In that case, it was a application to final cases. And the court said, we're going to do this three-part analysis. How important is the new rule to accurate fact-finding? How does it affect police reliance on the old rule? And how does it affect the administration of justice? So that was it was Linkletter that came up with that three-part rule. It was applied a couple years later to non-final cases, and it was applied in a number of cases after that, always with this balancing of the three parts and really, honestly, most often focusing on deterrence of police conduct in the retroactivity analysis. Then what happens in 1982 in United States versus Johnson, which is a Fourth Amendment case, it's the applicability of the Peyton decision on eavesdropping. The court looks back over that history of cases and said, you know what's really happened since 1965 is that we have taken out those cases where there's the purpose of the rule issue. Those cases, if the purpose is fact-finding, they always get applied retroactively. And then we take the other cases, and generally what's happened is if it's a new rule, one that overturns prior precedent, then it's never retroactive because of police reliance and the burden on the administration of justice. If it's just an old application, an old rule applied to new facts, then usually there is retroactivity because, of course, police and courts haven't relied on it. Now, Peyton was the situation, as they expressly point out, where it was open. It didn't fit in either of those two camps. And when they looked at that situation, they began to look at the discussion of the retroactivity rule. And they said, you know, this three-part analysis can be useful, but it's got real strong shortcomings. And they looked at Harlan's dissent and desist in a case called Mackey. And they said, Harlan's got some good points here. I mean, one of them is just the essence of court decision-making. We have a whole stream of cases pending. You have a number of cases pending on this issue. We pluck one or two out, and we issue a decision, and we give those defendants relief. And it doesn't fit with our idea of principled decision-making to say that the other defendants, whose cases we didn't pick out for whatever reason, don't get the same relief. It violates their right to get some equal relief, to be treated similarly, situation defendants to be treated similarly. The other very old concept of this, which is again repeated in Danforth, is that this is not a new part of the Constitution. It's a new, that constitutional right has always existed. It's just that the court has come to see it in a different light. And so those people whose constitutional rights were violated not because the Constitution didn't protect them, but because the court didn't see it that way at the time, should be entitled to the same relief when the court comes to realize that that constitutional right applies to them, should be applied to them.
Is Danforth limited to in the pipeline?
Danforth, as I recall, I think it's limited to in the pipeline. I'm not 100% sure. They still make the, I'm thinking Danforth might actually be, and maybe I can look it up, might actually be a habeas case in which they weighed that, but I'm not 100% sure.
I'll
no, actually,
that.
Danforth was a non-final case. So they still use, so what happened then is Johnson reviewed that analysis and said, okay, in our case where it's an open question, we are persuaded by the reasons behind the retroactivity rule that they are more important in this case than the reasons, than the three-part analysis. That we are persuaded by the dissents in our previous cases, and we are going to apply retroactivity to the Peyton case. Then we have Leon. Leon says, you know, actually Leon relies on the retroactivity cases. It says, you know, it's interesting, this our idea of this good faith exception to the exclusionary rule has actually been applied in other contexts. One of them has historically been in retroactivity. We've looked at the interest, the reliance by police. We've looked at the burden of administration of justice. So this is a test that's accepted in other areas. And then it distinguished itself from Johnson because it said, whatever the reasoning behind Johnson, the retroactivity decision in Johnson, as I just read from this footnote, it doesn't apply when you have a warrant and police reliance on a warrant. And then 3 years later, in 1987, in Griffith versus Kentucky, the Supreme Court says, we are no longer going to make an exception for clear break cases in retroactivity. In Johnson, they did not decide the issue where there had been a clear break from prior law. But in Griffith versus Kentucky in 1987, 3 years after Leon, they built on the Johnson case. They took the Johnson case and said, okay, we are persuaded by these rules for the retroactivity cases, and so we are going to make that a general rule applicable to all non-final cases, regardless of what the other reason, whatever those three reasons, how they fall out. So when you look at that history, you see that what happened is that the retroactivity reasons were adopted for purposes of the good faith exclusion. They were limited to cases in which there was a warrant. And then after that decision in Leon, the court said, we are no longer persuaded by these reasons. The retroactivity rule has reasons that override the reasons that are behind the good faith exception, except in cases where there's a warrant, like this good faith exception. So the retroactivity rule of Griffith, by its terms, because of this similar reasoning process that was then rejected in 1987, it says, really, that the reasons for the good faith exception do not apply in retroactivity cases. That's what the court decided in 1987, and to my understanding, that has never been seriously questioned since that date.
What has been the application of the retroactivity with respect to the Krull case?
With respect to what?
Krull.
That's the one exception to the warrant requirement. You're right. And that was a statute. And the statute in Krull allowed administrative searches of regulated business, of the property of a regulated business. In that case, they found that the statute was specific, that the rule fell within the statute, and that therefore the good faith exception would apply. In my view, that is certainly justified, because a statute like a search warrant is directed to a specific set of facts, and statutes are not governed by the retroactivity rule. It just doesn't apply. Retroactivity is not an issue that apply. That retroactivity rule is a rule of court decisions, not statutes. So it does not involve the conflict that this court runs into when it looks at the retroactivity rule and the good faith exclusion. The other thing I want to say about
other states or federal courts follow you, your reasoning. Now, Danforth is a pretty recent case.
It is, and it involves application of the Batson process. Since Gantt, there's been a fair amount of litigation about this, and that there are three federal circuits that have split on this issue. The Ninth Circuit held that the retroactivity rule governs. The Tenth Circuit and McCain held that it did not. The Ninth Circuit case is Gonzales, I believe. And recently, the 11th Circuit, as the Attorney General sent you last week in Davis, followed the decision in McCain. So it said that the retroactivity, that the good faith exception does apply. There's been a long list of U.S. District Court decisions. I haven't tried to keep a track of all of them or count them up. They're one-judge decisions, and I don't think that they're particularly persuasive to this court. There are a number of cases in state lower appellate courts that I found that go various ways. This is an area of a lot of churn right now. And I haven't found any other final Supreme Court state decisions, although I may have missed something along the way. There's quite a few in the Shepherd's part of the Gant case.
As I read the Gant case, one of the things that struck me was Justice Stevens' discussion on the ever-growing interpretation of Belton and the heavy reliance on that not only the court's decision, but, for example, he spoke about how there was law enforcement training that relied on that. And then there were a couple of quotes. I think one was from Justice O'Connor and another one was from Justice Scalia about, legion, I think Scalia said. You make a very cerebral and compelling argument, but what about the effect on the administration of justice here? How many cases are there in which there has been, objectively reasonable reliance on these decisions?
First, I want to thank you because I'm rarely called cerebral. Nobody knows the answer to the bottom line question of how many. We were just talking before the argument. We know we have these two cases in this court. Between the Attorney General's office and my office, we can count three in the courts of appeals. There may be more, but that's what we're aware of. Certainly, there are probably hundreds and thousands of instances in which officers have searched cars incident to arrest, believing that they were doing so under Belton. And that really goes, that requires you first, though, to reject the retroactivity rule, because the retroactivity rule says we don't care, that the important thing is not the temporary burden on the administration of justice or what officers reasonably relied on. The important thing with the retroactivity analysis is the integrity of the decision-making process. It goes to the very norms of constitutional adjudication by the court. So that's my first answer.
What I'm really trying to get at is, and you can attack what I'm going to say, but by repeatedly citing the reliance of law enforcement on this interpretation in Arizona versus Gant, wasn't that sending a signal?
I think not, for a couple of reasons. Several reasons. One is the Gant court specifically said, we are not overturning Belton. They're saying, despite the fact that many courts and probably thousands of law enforcement and training academies interpreted Belton in this way, there really isn't textual support for that. I pulled it up. I just look at some of the things I've highlighted. Is the state exaggerated the clarity that its reading of Belton provides? It says there's many interpretations of Belton, and there's disagreeing interpretations of Belton. They say, despite this widespread misreading of Belton, if you read Belton, it's very closely hooked to Schimmel versus California, and you can't take it that far without violating that basic constitutional requirement. They also point out, I think very interestingly, because I think the case that got me interested in this was the Scalia's dissent in Thornton in 2004, 2 years before the search in this case. And they point out in Belton that they've noticed that there isn't a drop-off on searches incident to arrest, even after Thornton. So I think there's a suggestion, at least, that the court is thinking, but boy, we hinted at this, and still nobody's picking it up. Now, the other thing I want to point out is that the Belton court, even though the dissent says, boy, this is going to throw the administration in turmoil, affirmed the decision of the Arizona Supreme Court, which had suppressed the evidence. It cited no hesitation about doing so, and in fact, it responded to that footnote obliquely, or that comment in Scalia's dissent. I mean, in two ways. One is, we're not overturning Belton. We're interpreting it the correct way. And two, probably there won't be civil liability, because the civil liability is similar to the good faith rule. So even though that point was made in Belton, my reading of Belton is they're saying, A, there was not reasonable reliance because they were unreasonably reading this case. And second, that the retroactivity rule obviously governs, and those factors, those considerations behind the retroactivity rule mean that the reliance is not as important as the reasons for the retroactivity rule. And let me just say on this too, the other important distinction in my case is that Mr. Dearborn's truck was locked and he was secured in the police car. That was not the situation in Belton. The facts of Belton are very different from the facts of Mr. Dearborn's case. And so whether that was reasonable reliance, I think, is an open question, and particularly after the Supreme Court decision in Thornton.
Counsel, before you get seated, you haven't talked about the anonymity issues, so I assume you're relying on your briefs.
I am relying on the briefs. If the court has questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
But number two, is Dearborn similar to, let's see what it is, Little John?
Absolutely.
Relating to this issue?
I believe that they're very, very close to one another on this issue.
Can the court decide these two just on this issue differently and be consistent?
I can't see a reason to make a distinction between Little John and Dearborn. Maybe Mr. Schmall later will find one, but I don't see
one. counsel for the state the same question.
And I've talked with him about that. So.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Lossy.
May it please the court, I'm Assistant Attorney General Michael Lossy, and I represent the state in this case. From the onset, the order, of course, that we would like the court to enter is to affirm the Court of Appeals, of course, on the jury instructions for the issues just raised in our briefs, but also not suppressing the evidence on the grounds of what's been called the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, but what the courts are now stating, and in Herring, it's more appropriately called whether or not the exclusionary rule applies to begin with.
Whether the exclusionary rule applies to what?
Whether or not the exclusionary rule applies where there is no substantial deterrence of police misconduct to be had.
Okay, let's just start at the beginning. You agree that if this were to happen today, the police should not have opened that car under Gant?
We agree that under Gant, that search of the vehicle was not lawful.
All right, that's good. Now, from there, the question is whether it's suppressed.
Correct.
Okay.
First off, Justice, to add to your other question, I believe that Dearborn and Little John are substantially identical in terms of the court's analysis. There is a different nuance in the arguments made, but they are consistent. And the issue is the same.
Thank you.
The overriding two points I would make are, first of all, I find my opponent did give a very cerebral and good argument on retroactivity that I don't think I can match point for point. The state relies on the arguments made in McCain and now Davis, which is the 11th Circuit, a new case coming down in March. I notified the court as soon as I found out about it, which unfortunately was just last Thursday, and filed notice of it. Both those circuits have simply rejected the notion that retroactivity governs here. The state would adopt their argument. They do not parse it out the way the appellant has here, but rather go back to Herring, and that is the second overriding point I would make. The appellant's argument in this case is based upon writing off Herring essentially as dicta, or I think the words used in the appellant's reply brief where the court's language goes far beyond the holding and therefore it isn't helpful in this analysis. The state adamantly agrees. Herring is a watershed case on the applicability of the exclusionary rule, and it says without any equivocation that suppression is not a personal remedy or right. It is only done when there is substantial future deterrence of police misconduct. That is absolutely unequivocal. And it is the U.S. Supreme Court, of course, that wrote Leon in 1984. This isn't 1984 anymore. It is the U.S. Supreme Court that wrote Danforth in 2008 and then Griffith in 2007. And the court says, admittedly, they don't parse through all of this retroactivity stuff, but they say time and time again and unequivocally that suppression, the exclusionary rule, can only apply when the court has made a reasoned determination that there's future police misconduct to deter, and that's it.
Counsel, I don't have the Herring case with me. I have it in another file for this afternoon. But my recollection obviously is consistent with the statements that you're making in terms of the vitality of the good faith exception or the applicability of the exclusionary rule. My question is this. If Herring, as I recall, not really discussing retroactivity, how can it inform our decision with regard to what might be considered the tension between the retroactivity doctrine and the good faith exclusion?
Justice, I think because it doesn't directly address retroactivity, I don't think it on its face, it doesn't totally reconcile the tension. It simply doesn't.
It just is another you-rah-rah with regard to your position on the application or inapplicability of the exclusionary rule. I mean, it reaffirms it, it embraces it, but it doesn't go the next step of addressing the question that I think we have before us, and that is, does one trump the other? What's the interplay between the two?
Justice, the only thing I could say to that is when the court says the rule does not apply absent these conditions, that at least by implication trumps retroactivity. It says it doesn't apply unless the court has engaged in this balancing test and found substantial police misconduct. And I hasten to add, I'm sure the justice already knows this, but what is even more watershed about Herring is that it dealt with police misconduct. Perhaps that's a wrong word, but it dealt with police negligence and the record-keeping system. And in
said it was isolated, if I recall Herring, it was isolated and attenuated. It emphasized both of those things.
That's
with
correct.
Regard to the police records. There was a one-shot deal, and it was from a neighboring law enforcement agency that had made the mistake. And so it was both an isolated event and attenuated from the arrest.
That's correct, Justice.
You know,
as far as the diffusing the tension, and I don't think I can conclusively do that because the court hasn't done it for us yet, and what can I say? But it would be the arguments advanced in Davis, 11th Circuit, McCain, 10th Circuit, and I also filed in my letter, by the way, that cert was denied in that case. It says that the whole retroactivity argument is off point. They concede there's retroactivity. It's just that the retroactivity is limited to the question that the Supreme Court answered. And the only question put before it was the lawfulness of the search, not the remedy. That's the best I can do to diffuse the tension.
You know what's bothering me? You make a very good argument selecting, as we all do, sentences out of a long opinion of the U.S. Supreme Court, several sentences from different opinions. And Ms. Hirsch does the same thing. And you try and tell a story, and you try and, in effect, predict what the United States Supreme Court would do if this case came to it. And from my perspective of having to rule on this, I want to use some good legal sense. Now, I am not willing to go back dozens of years and answer people's petitions here to say, hey, they should have never searched my car on DeGant. Open it up. Give me a clean bill of health. Can't get jobs. I can't get married. I got a record. Can't get housing. And it's unfair. I can't do that. I accept that as a practical matter. In an ideal world, it's wrong, because the Constitution has not changed since these amendments were adopted, right?
Right.
The only thing that was an error was not Belton, but numerous courts that, quote, misinterpret Belton. I'm not so sure they did, but that's what the United States Supreme Court said they did. And we have to live with that. So the Constitution has been the same. These people should not have had that evidence to suppress them. Okay, we've got to be practical. Well, why are we practical here? We have a limited number of cases, really, that are in the pipeline. Is that right?
That's my belief, Justice.
Yeah. Okay, it's my belief, too. Got a limited number of cases in the pipeline. And we are fighting about whether we should grant these defendants a constitutional right that the United States Supreme Court has said they've had since the 18th century, when the Bill of Rights was adopted. Why don't you just give it to them? They have it under the Constitution. Just give it to them. It's not a great cost to the system to say you have these constitutional rights. They're yours. I'm not opening up a million cases. Who are we offending? Are we offending the police? The police did a good job. They did what this court has said they can do in a number of cases, right?
Yes.
Right. It's not the law enforcement's fault. They followed what they thought was the rule. They followed right from the letter of our cases. And our opinion should say that. This is no blemish on the law enforcement officer, right?
Correct.
All right. So should we say, well, we can't let them out because they're guilty of the offense? It's dangerous to society. That is just undercuts the whole system, which says we only convict in a constitutional way in this country. So why are we parsing all this language, and then we're going to find out in 2 years the United States Supreme Court is going to go one way or it's going to go the other way? And you don't know which way they're going to go, do you?
I guess I wouldn't be betting my retirement on it, Justice.
Well, I'm not going to retire, so we don't have to worry about that. So But that's the point. That's my whole point. Why don't we just use some, I don't want to violate any United States Supreme Court case. I don't want to violate the Wisconsin Constitution. Well, why don't we just look at this in terms of, I don't want to use common sense, but just the concepts of constitutionality. Justice, I don't think you can explain to any layperson why this evidence should be used against Mr. Dearborn, but cannot ever be used again, at least until the court changes its mind.
Justice, the only answer I could give to that I know would not be very satisfying, but the concept of suppression is of course based in doctrines and law and rules. And the court in January of 2009 told us it's not a personal right. You may well have a right to the Constitution, you know, various constitutional rights, et cetera, but the remedy is a whole different matter.
Our court has said that there's a double-barreled concept in exclusion. And the second barrel is judicial integrity.
If I may weigh in on this subject, I recently had the opportunity to speak to the Waupaca County Bar Association. And there was a dinner. I'm seated at a table with four judges. Two of the judges told me that they had Gantt cases. And both of those judges said they had not applied it retroactively. They had applied the rule that you're talking about. So Waupaca County isn't exactly the most populous area of the state. So if there are two cases in Waupaca County, I suspect there are a lot of cases. Now, in your oversight of the criminal cases in the state of Wisconsin, do you have a sense that there are other cases that perhaps aren't in the pipeline in a formal sense, and that they're being appealed, or what sense do you have of what's going on out there?
Justice, I know there are some others. I mean, recently if I can, just as I try to think through an answer to you, because I don't have the broad knowledge of what's going on in the whole unit. But some have come to me, and one or two of them we decided, for lack of resources, we just aren't going to appeal it. In this case, they had another felony charge to go on the guy with. I have recently filed another Gantt-like case where the court did suppress it, and we've raised good faith again.
Would you stand in front of the microphone?
I'm sorry. Your point is well taken, Justice, but I think I would be misrepresenting what I know and pretending to know what I don't know if I were to tell you there's many. I know there are some. I know there are some where the DAs are just sitting on them. There's more than just a couple. That most assuredly is true. And I think people are waiting, be it district attorney. Of course, you have those appeal limits, but I think some people are waiting just to sort of get a sense of how quickly this court might decide the issue, because there's, I think, there's four good faith cases pending before this court now, Hess, Robinson, and these two, maybe another. And so I guess some cases will die along the way by waiting too long. But I wouldn't feel comfortable misrepresenting things and saying that there's many, many, like more than 100. I know there's more than 10. I just don't know, and I'm sorry.
Well, suppose defense counsel moved to suppress the evidence based on Gantt, and that was denied on the basis that that you are arguing here, and it wasn't appealed. Is that malpractice?
Pardon?
Is that malpractice if it wasn't appealed? It isn't in the pipeline?
Ooh. I think from the one legal malpractice case I ever had in my life, the standard is so high that it wouldn't be malpractice. If you're asking would it be ineffective assistance of counsel, I recollect the controlling law there to be it's not ineffective assistance to fail to raise a disputed issue, or one where you're pretty sure the trial court at least would deny. So I realize that to say it's malpractice helps my case, but I don't want to overstate things. I don't know. It certainly would be safer for the defense lawyer to be raising all these things, to be sure.
And get him on frivolousness. Justice Crooks has a question or comment.
Yeah, I've been trying to get you to focus on something a little bit different. You've told us that, as I understood your argument, that McCain and Davis are based on Herring, that's the case that you said was a watershed case. As you know, a number of years ago, this court adopted Eason, and we decided that there would be a good faith exception in Wisconsin, but it was structured somewhat differently than the Leon good faith exception. And I want you to tell me, if you can, how Herring and Eason line up with each other. You think they're consistent with each other, or do you think they're off in different directions?
I think they are consistent, Justice, because first off, paragraph 52 in Eason speaks about comparing Krull and Leon and Ward and Eason, and talks to the issue of deterrent effect and relying upon controlling law. That is the underlying theme of Herring, prospective deterrent effect. I also recollect from the facts of Eason that there was some police errors as to whether or not they had dotted the I's, crossed the T's as to grounds for a no-knock. And the court, therefore, that there was at least some marginal negligence on their part. And the court stated that wasn't sufficient to deny applicability of the exclusionary rule in that instance. I also, of course, this court has put on those two other requirements for the Leon exception. You know, it's been referred to as Leon Plus, significant in investigation and review by police officer trained or a knowledgeable government attorney. Now, of course, when you're not exactly in a warrant situation, not all of the original four Leon criteria are applicable, and one has to adopt the two that this court added in Eason. But I do think what we're arguing for here is all consistent. The reason the police make almost routine searches of vehicles upon arrest is because they are categorically so well trained as to what this court said in Fry and other cases, Pallone, Denk thereafter, and also what has been widely understood to be the rule until Gant. So short answer to your question is yes, I think it's wholly consistent. And this is also because going back to what I understand to be the first of this court's decisions regarding the so-called good faith exception, Collins in 84, right after Leon came down, as I cited in my brief, this court has a number of times noted that the purpose of the exclusionary rules deter future police conduct, and as in Collins, has even let pass a certain negligent a certain police negligence where it wasn't repetitive and reckless and deliberate. Therefore, I believe there is consistency here. This A third point I had wanted to make is the court's questions and the implication behind them are well understood. But I do think this is a matter of policy. We're dealing with so many conflicting, we're dealing with conflicting doctrines, tension between retroactivity, vehicle searches, good faith exception, applicability of the exclusionary rule. We're dealing with with strong dissents on the state level and the federal level. Gant is 5-4, Herring's 5-4. We're dealing with some disputes between jurisdictions. You know, there's the 10th and the 11th lining up one way, the 9th lining up another way. And it's very difficult to parse it out.
Why isn't my policy the good one? Or you tell me a better policy.
Pardon?
Or you give me a better policy.
Well, all I could say to the better policy, Justice, is, and of course it may not be, I say that advisedly, is that the exclusionary rule doesn't apply. It's not an automatic remedy. One thing that comes to mind in getting to the point of your question, Chief Justice, is I do see some distinction, even if not categorical, when we're talking about a person who was obviously guilty. I realize the constitutional rights apply to criminals too. But when one is talking about policy, I see some difference when there's a guy who's cruising around with a dope full of pot in his mom's car from Griffith, which was where the prosecutor is trying to strike black jurors from the jury under Batson. I see something of a difference there, maybe even only degree.
So does it depend on what the crime is? If it were murder, then you're going to say, no, we're going to uphold the conviction, we won't suppress. If it's a small amount of marijuana that could have been prosecuted as a civil forfeiture, we will suppress. I mean, I'm trying to figure out what you're saying.
I know any answer I have wouldn't.
It's not going to be intellectually satisfying, but at least you'll have some basis for distinguishing.
All I keep coming back to, Justice, is that the exclusionary rule just wouldn't apply unless there's police deterrence and we're talking about the wrong things.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, Counsel, if you could spend a few minutes talking about the exclusionary rule and how it started and when it started. And what it was, you've already talked about what it was meant to address, but perhaps some historical context might be helpful for us to understand your argument.
The Herring Court, I'm afraid I don't have that readily in mind, Justice, but the Herring Court did go back to the Weeks decision and said that decision, which it attributes to starting the exclusionary rule, came as a result of persistent police misconduct that couldn't be ameliorated by other means. And then the rule was enunciated. It's always been a matter of dealing with police that, in the court's words, were overly zealous. And ergo, my answers to the Chief Justice's questions, it's a rule with a limited purpose. It is an omnibus, and it isn't a personal right.
Well, and that seems to be the tension here. Seems to be Ms. Hirsch makes the point, and the Chief Justice has as well, about the fact of the Constitution hasn't changed, and why should its application, the question posed would be, why should its application depend on when the person was arrested versus application of a judicially created, very recent, my recollection, I don't have the memory right in hand either, but my recollection is that the exclusionary rule was developed sometime in the 1960s to curb police abuses. So really, that's the tension, unless there's something else. That seems to be somewhat in a nutshell, perhaps overly simplified, but it seems to be a fair enough characterization of the tension between the two points of view.
Yeah, I believe that's correct, Justice. The other point that I would like to raise is there has been some discussion in the briefs as to whether there's ever been precedent for applying the good faith exception for reliance on precedent. Well, first of all, as I pointed out, there is some language to that effect in Wisconsin good faith exception cases. And also the Fifth Circuit has done that, and that's articulated in either the Davis and or the McCain cases, what the Fifth Circuit did in finding a good faith exception on reliance on precedent. There's also been some discussion of the Seventh Circuit, and I just want to touch upon those cases if I could. That case, County Highway E, is cited for the proposition that the Seventh Circuit didn't think it was a good idea to let police interpret precedent. As a matter of fact, though, they did give good faith exception to the magistrate that then relied upon the same precedent that the police did. They just wouldn't give it to the police directly. And that was a Sowell thermal imaging case from the Seventh Circuit. But then our brief discusses the Sims and the Guzman cases in the Seventh Circuit in 2009, one before Gant, one after. And I realize members of this court may not find that persuasive at all, and it was somewhat philosophical, legal, social policy discussions, not exactly on point. But both Judge Posner and Judge Evans talked about that the Fourth Amendment law is just full of exceptions that are created so that the courts don't have to apply the exclusionary rule. And they went through this laundry list. Good faith exception is one, exigent circumstances, expanding consent to apparent authorization, and others. Now, I'm not suggesting here, taking a position beyond what I need to, that the exclusionary rule should be abrogated. But I am saying these are policy decisions, and I think this boils down to this court deciding if it's going to add even further protections to the interpretation of Wisconsin Article 1, Section 11. I believe that under federal law, it is not persuasive at all to say that the good faith exception wouldn't apply here, and I think in light of Herring, it clearly does. The issue then is the Wisconsin Constitution and what this court thinks is good social policy. And that isn't
the constitutional policy under Article 1, Section 11.
Correct, Justice. And that isn't intended to indicate any lack of faith in the arguments I made, especially in light of all the language that appears in this court's good faith cases. But it is intended to recognize the obvious that this is what the seven justices here sitting down and deciding what's a good direction for us to go in and what isn't. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Hirsch?
First of all, I couldn't disagree more that this is a policy decision. I believe, and this goes to Justice Gableman's question, I think, and I'm just going to reiterate this, and I want to just do a little tangent here. To be as cerebral as me, you have to look at the footnote in McCain, and then you have to read three cases. You have to read Johnson, you have to read Leon, and you have to read Griffith. I think if you do that and you read those cases carefully, and I went and checked a few sites and things, but you don't even have to do that. If you read those cases carefully, you will see, I believe, that the United States Supreme Court has addressed the issue of police deterrence and has said in this category of cases where we have a change in the interpretation by courts of the Constitution, in that category, the point of police deterrence is overridden by the essential constitutional norms under which courts operate. And I believe that, as Justice Abramson said, there is no clear decision that says, okay, you know, we're going to line up the retroactivity rule and the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule. But I think that the way you get guidance on that is to read those three cases. And I think when you read those three cases, you will agree that the retroactivity rule governs, even in Fourth Amendment cases where there otherwise could be exclusion, because of the importance of these constitutional norms. And so that's my answer to Justice Gableman and to Justice Abramson, too. I don't think this is a clear playing field. I think the Supreme Court has given a very clear direction. And I would point out that the Seventh Circuit has, too. I was going to mention that, Mr. Lossie did, that when we talked about the cases since Gant, I talked about the Ninth, Tenth, and Eleventh Circuit. They all mentioned the Seventh Circuit in this case of real property versus, I call it, 12345 County E. And it's some combination of those numbers. They say in that case that the law changed. The Supreme Court changed the rule on thermal imaging. And because the magistrate relied on it, we're going to find good faith in that case. But if it had been the police in what they call naked reliance, we will not, and they give policy reasons for that. And they say that we don't want the police to have an incentive to interpret case law, which is never as clear as warrants or statutes. Never as clear. Does Belton apply to this case? Depends on, I mean, it's a different fact situation. Does Frye apply to this
didn't
case?
They make, different didn't they fact make situation. A, didn't they distinguish the facts in that case, though, that the law concerning the thermal imaging had not been well developed? It was relatively recent. I think they even pointed out reliance on one case that was appealed. I don't know that that's a fair comparison to be comprehensive to the law in regard to what we're talking about here.
That could be. I mean, you may be right about that. I didn't look at that part of it. I was just looking at where they said this was a warrant situation. And versus what they called naked reliance by police officers. And so there's another, I'm just saying, obviously it's not a controlling decision on the issue. The U.S. Supreme Court is not giving you a controlling decision, but they're certainly giving you guidance in these cases, and I think that that's important. If you're looking at policy, I have a few policy considerations for you to consider. One is it opens a can of worms. What is the controlling law? If we say police officers can rely on controlling law, is it this court's decisions? Is it the Seventh Circuit's decisions? If we have different decisions, what controls? Interestingly, in the 10th and 11th circuits, they say clear decisions by our circuit. And I couldn't help but reading that and thinking, what do the Supreme Courts in the states in that circuit think of that rule? Is it the state Supreme Court? Is it the federal circuit court? If it's not the federal circuit court, is it the district circuit, the district federal court? Which court will control this rule if you make that decision? And how close do the facts have to be? Do they, as in Eason, do the police have to go and say, well, the facts of this case aren't exactly the same as Belton, Mr. District Attorney, or Mr. Magistrate, Mr. Judge. Do you think that this case controls or not? Do they have to get the extra advice? Because as the Seventh Circuit said in that real property case, we don't want police officers to be doing what a lawyer does or what a judge does, which is interpreting case law. They're not qualified to do that. They certainly get trained, and many of them are very good, but they're not trained to analyze case law. And so if you go with the policy considerations, you're going to have to make a lot of decisions about which cases apply, which court's decisions apply. If there's a split between the courts of appeals in Wisconsin, do they apply? I think it opens a can of worms that will have you litigating these cases for many years to come. And finally, I just want to say one thing about Mr. Lossie said, we just have to look at hearing, you know, Leon was so many years ago. If the court makes the mistake of not going back to Leon, it will be the same mistake that the Supreme Court said in Arizona versus Gant that had been made in not going back to the roots of Belton. You know, the problem was, they said, we said in Belton that we were not untethering. This did not untether it from its constitutional foundations in Schimmel. And then everybody went with this rule, and they ran with the rule, and they said, here's what this case says, and we're going to go this. And they didn't go back and look at what are the foundations of the case. History matters. Herring is based on Leon. You have to go back and read Leon to see what Herring holds.
Well, as I remember the history of the exclusionary rule started out in federal court with Weeks versus the United States. Of course, I have the benefit of having LaFave here.
Yes.
So he refreshed my recollection.
That was my understanding, but I wouldn't have sworn to it.
Well, okay, and that was 1914. It was a lottery case. They searched and found lottery tickets. And the court said in that, only applicable to the feds, because in 1914, the 14th Amendment wasn't viewed as incorporating some of the first 10. So it said, the effect of the Fourth Amendment is to put the courts of the United States and federal officials in the exercise of their power and authority under limitations and restraints, as talking about federal and state officials and courts, restraints. This protection reaches all alike, whether accused of crime or not, and the duty of giving to it force and effect is obligatory upon all entrusted under our federal system with the enforcement of law. The tendency of those who execute the laws of the country to obtain conviction by means of unlawful seizures should find no sanction in the judgments of the courts, which are charged at all times with the support of the Constitution, and to which people of all conditions have a right to appeal for the maintenance of such fundamental rights. To sanction unlawful invasion, and this was the home, would be to affirm by judicial decision manifest neglect, if not open defiance, blah, blah, intended for the protection. So originally, the exclusionary rule was designed for the integrity of the court, not to sanction unconstitutional intrusions. It then became a double purpose. Deter, that was Map v. Ohio, to which Justice Gableman made reference, which was a 1961 case, if I've got the right, but it was in the 60s. Mm-hmm. And then it became double and triple barreled as to purpose. And then in later cases, the United States Supreme Court has whittled that down to deterrence. That's the history, as I understand it.
I agree with that history, and I would point out that the U.S. Supreme Court has whittled that down in terms of cases involving warrants. And the reason they give is because that
if you're
gives
too
us,
strict with warrants, you'll never get a good warrant.
They're the preferred under the reasonableness grounds, and they are the check on police action.
Right.
Applying it in this case leaves unchecked police action in interpreting court cases.
There's no warrant here.
Pardon?
There's no warrant here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hirsch. Thank you both to Ms. Hirsch and to Mr. Lossy for dealing in a very difficult area where the law is very unclear. And both of your briefs in your oral arguments have successfully attempted on each of your respective sides to explain both the strengths and weaknesses of your position, which I think is very helpful to the court. So I want to thank you both for doing that. That ends our hearing in 07AP1894CR State versus Dearborn. We're going to take a few minutes of recess, so those who are here and want to leave may do so, and I think we have some other students who are scheduled to come in. And if Professor Melly would approach the bench.